mission was leading a mob of warriors on horseback with a sword waving in the air, but he'd learned a few hard lessons in the darkness south of the berm, which put him one up on a lot of men who'd died from not learning fast enough. The day's fighting began after a pause from both movement and killing that would afterward seem as stylized as the halftime of a football game. The reason the Saudi 4th survivors had garnered the time and space to reorganize and replenish was that the Army of God had to do the same. Trailing elements refueled from the Bowsers, which had followed the combat units. Then they leapfrogged forward, allowing the fuel trucks to succor the erstwhile advance units. That process took 4 hours. The brigade and divisional commanders were pleased to this point. They were only 10 kilometers behind the plan. Plans are always too optimistic, in distance and an hour in time. The refueling took place almost on schedule as well. They'd smashed the initial opposition, taking more losses than hoped, but crushing their foe in any case. Men were tired, but soldiers were supposed to be tired too, everyone thought, and the time for refueling allowed most to nap enough to freshen them. With the coming of dawn, the Army of God started its diesel engines and renewed its drive south. The first battles this day would be aloft. The Allied air forces started taking off in numbers just after 4 from bases in the southern portion of the kingdom. The first rank of aircraft were F-15 Eagles, which joined up with 3 circling E-3B AWACS aircraft lined up east and west of Riyadh. The UIR fighters rose as well, still in the control of ground radar stations inside the former country of Iraq. It began as a sort of dance between 2 chorus lines. Both sides wanted to know where the other side's SAMs were, information on which had been gathered during the dark hours. Both sides, it was gradually determined, would have a missile belt to hide behind. But in both cases, the initial battles would be fought in an electronic no-man's land. The first move was by a flight of 4 from the 390th Fighter Squadron, the Wild Boars. Alerted by their control aircraft that a UIR flight had turned east, the Eagles angled west, went to burner, and darted across the empty space, reversing course back toward the sea as they did so. The Americans expected to win, and they did. The UIR fighters, actually Iranian F-4s left over from the time of the Shah, were caught looking the wrong way. Warned by their ground controllers, they turned back, but their problem was deeper than the tactical situation. They'd expected an engagement pattern in which one side would fire missiles and the other would evade, then turn back to fire its own in a style of encounter as rigid as a medieval joust. Nobody had told them that this was not how their American enemies were trained. The Eagles fired first, loosing 1 AMRAAM each. It was a fire-and-forget missile, which allowed them to retreat after shooting. But they didn't, and instead bored in behind them, following both their doctrine and inclinations after 10 hours of contemplating what their president had said on the radio. It was all personal now, and the first team of Eagle drivers kept closing while their missiles tracked in on the first group of targets. 3 of the 4 targets were destroyed, adversely surprised by the missile American pilots called the Slammer. The 4th evaded, blessed his luck, and turned back to fire off his own weapon, only to see on his radar that there was a fighter 15 kilometers distant, with a closure rate of nearly 2,000 knots. That made him flinch and turn south. A mistake. The Eagle pilot, his wingman 0.5 mile behind, chopped power to slow down and got in a tail-chase position. He wanted an eyeball kill, and he got it, closing on the enemy's 6 and selecting guns. The other guy was a little slow to catch on this morning. In 15 more seconds, the F-4 expanded to fill the gun sight. Fox 3 for a kill. A second flight of Eagles was in the combat area now, going after their own targets. The UIR ground controllers were startled by the speed of the result, and ordered their fighters to point at the oncoming Americans and fire off their radar-guided long-range missiles. But even then, the Americans did not run away to evade as expected. Instead, their tactic was to roll 90 degrees to the ground and maintain an even distance to the launching aircraft. That denied the fighter radars a Doppler, or range rate change, to their targets, broke radar lock, and sent the missiles into random, unguided courses. Then the Eagles turned in, selected their own missiles, and shot from under 10 miles while the UIR fighters were trying to reacquire and fire another volley, again boring in behind them. Warned that more missiles were in the air, the enemy fighters tried to turn and run, but they were too far inside the slammer envelope, and all four of them were blotted out as well. "Hey, dude, this is Bronco," a voice taunted over the UIR guard channel. "Send us some more. We're hungry. We want to shoot 'em all down and fuck their old ladies." He switched channels to Sky One. "Razorback lead, more business, over." "Not in your sector. Stand by." "Roger that." The lieutenant colonel commanding the 390th rolled sideways again, looking down to see the massed tanks moving out from their assembly points. And for the first time in his life, he wished that he was air to mud instead of air to air. Colonel Winters came from New York. There were sick people there, he knew, and here he was at war against those who had caused it. But he'd killed only 2 aircraft, and just 3 people so far. "Razorback lead, form up on me." Then he checked his fuel state. He'd have to tank soon. Next in were the Strike Eagles of the 391st, escorted by HARM-equipped F-16s. The smaller single-seat fighters cruised in with their threat receivers on, sniffing for mobile SAM launchers. There turned out to be a goodly collection of low-altitude missile vehicles, French Crotals and old Russian SA-6 Gainfuls, just behind the lead echelons. The Viper drivers jinked down to draw their attention, then fired off their anti-radar missiles to cover the inbound F-15Es. Those were looking for enemy artillery, first of all. The Predators were working on that. 3 had crashed with the loss of their ground control at Stormtrack, creating a gap in intelligence coverage that had taken hours to rectify. There were only 10 left in theater. 4 of those were up and flying at 8,000 feet, loitering almost invisibly over the advancing divisions. The UIR forces relied mostly on towed tubes. These were now setting up for the next major attack, lined up behind 2 mechanized brigades about to make the next leap toward KKMC. 1 Predator found the 6 battery group. The data went to a collection team, then up to the AWACS and back down to the 16 Strike Eagles of the 391st. The Saudi formation waited tensely. Their 44 fighting vehicles were spread over 8 kilometers, as wide as the major commanding them dared, having to balance dispersal against firepower in what he hoped would be at least a delaying action, and maybe a stand. An approaching scream in the sky told him and his men to button up, as 8-inch shells started landing in front of his position. The initial bombardment lasted 3 minutes, the rounds advancing toward where his vehicles were. "Tigers in hot," the strike commander called. The enemy had evidently expected his first attack to go after the leading tanks. That's where the SAMs were, and the Vipers were trying to deal with them. The 3 flights of 4 separated, then split into elements of 2, coming down to 4,000 feet, smoking in at 500 knots. The gun batteries were lined up nice and neat in even lines, the cannons spaced about 100 meters apart, along with their trucks, just like their manual must have said, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Berman thought. His weapons system operator selected cluster munitions and started sprinkling them with bomblets. "Looking good." They had dropped 2 canisters of BLU-97 combined effects munitions, a total of over 400 softball-sized mini-bombs. The first battery was wiped out when the pattern covered their position. Secondary explosions erupted from the ammo trucks. "Next." The pilot reefed his fighter into a tight right turn. His wizzo called him back around toward the next battery. Then he spotted AAA at 10. That proved to be a ZSU-23 mobile anti-aircraft vehicle, whose 4 guns started sending tracers at their Strike Eagle, selecting MAV. This death dance lasted just a few seconds. The Eagle evaded fire and got off a Maverick air-to-ground missile, which streaked down to obliterate the gun track, and then the pilot went after the next battery of howitzers. It was like Red Flag, the pilot thought in a blink. He'd been here in 1991 as a captain and killed targets, but mainly wasted his time in scud hunts. The experience of real combat had never measured up to battle practice in the Nellis Air Force Base weapons range. It did now. The mission was only planned in a general sense. He was looking for targets in real time with look-down radar and Mark I eyeball. And unlike his playtime at Nellis, these guys were shooting back with real bullets. Well, he was dropping real bombs, too. More ground fire started up as he lined his aircraft on the next collection of targets. It seemed, of all things, like a cough in the middle of a conversation. There was a final crash of 20 or 30 rounds on the desert 100 meters in front of his position. 30 seconds later, 10 more fell. 30 seconds after that, only 3. On the horizon, well behind the first row of tanks just appearing, there were dust clouds. Some seconds later, they felt something through their boots, and after that a distant rumble. It became clear in a few seconds. Green-painted fighters appeared, heading due south. They were friendly, he saw from their shape. Then another appeared, trailing smoke, staggering in the sky, then tipping over, and 2 objects jolted out of it, turning into parachutes that drifted to the ground a kilometer behind his position, as the fighter smashed down separately, making an immense fireball. The major dispatched a vehicle to pick them up, then returned his attention to tanks still out of range. And he had no artillery to call in on them as yet. Well, shit, the colonel thought. It was like Red Flag after all. Except this night wouldn't be spent telling lies in the O Club and sneaking off to Vegas for a show and some time in a casino. His third pass had run him into fire, and the Eagle was too sick to make it all the way home. He wasn't even on the ground yet when he saw a vehicle coming toward him, and he wondered whose it was. A moment later it looked like an American-made Hummer, 50 meters away when he hit the ground, jolting hard on the packed sand. He popped the release on his chute and pulled his pistol out, but sure enough the vehicle was friendly, with 2 Saudi soldiers in it. One came over to him, while the other took the Hummer to where the Wizzo was standing half a mile away. "Come, come," the Saudi private said. A minute later the Hummer was back with the Wizzo, who was holding his knee and grimacing. "Twisted it bad, boss. Landed on a fucking rock," he explained, getting in one of the back seats. Everything he'd heard about Saudi drivers was true, the colonel learned in a few seconds. It was like being inside a Burt Reynolds movie, as the Hummer bounded its way back to the safety of the Wadi. But it was good to see the shapes of friendly vehicles there. The Hummer took him to what had to be the command post. There were still some shells falling forward of their position, but their aim had worsened, now dropping the shells 500 meters short. "Who are you?" Lieutenant Colonel Steve Berman asked. "Major Abdullah." The man even saluted. Berman holstered his pistol and looked around. "I guess you're the guys we came to support. We took out their artillery pretty good, but some bastard got lucky with his Shilka. Can you get us a chopper?" "I will try. Are you injured?" "My Wizzo had a bum knee. We could use something to drink, though." Major Abdullah handed over his canteen. "We have an attack coming in." "Mind if I watch?" Berman asked. 100 miles to the south, Eddington's brigade was still forming. He had 1 battalion pretty much intact. This he moved 20 miles forward, left and right of the road to KKMC, to screen the rest of his forces as they came up the road from Dharan. Unhappily, his artillery was the last group to have been offloaded, and they weren't due for at least another 4 hours. But that couldn't be helped. As units arrived, he first of all got them to assembly areas where they could top off their fuel tanks. What with getting people off the road, directed to their intermediate destinations, and gassed up, it took about 1 hour per company to get things organized. His 2nd battalion was just about ready to move. This one he would send west of the road, which would allow the first one to move laterally to the east and double his advanced security force. It was so hard to explain to people that fighting battles was more about traffic control than killing people. That and gathering information. A combat action was like the last act of a massive ballet. Most of the time it was just getting the dancers to the right parts of the stage. The two acts, knowing where to send them and then getting them there, were interactive, and Eddington still didn't have a very clear picture. His brigade intelligence group was just setting up and starting to get hard information from Riyadh. Forward, his lead battalion had a reconnaissance screen of Humvees and Bradleys 10 miles in advance of the main force, all of them hunkered down, their vehicles hidden as best they could be, and the troops on their bellies, scanning forward with binoculars, so far reporting nothing but the occasional wisp of dust well beyond the visible horizon and the rumbles of noise that carried amazingly far. Well, Eddington decided, so much the better. He had time to prepare, and time was the most valuable commodity a soldier could hope for.
Lobo 6, this is Wolfpack 6, over.
Lobo 6 copies.
This is Wolfpack 6 actual. White Fang is moving out now. He should be on your left in an hour. You may commence your lateral movement when they arrive online. Over.
Lobo 6 actual copies, Colonel. Still nothing to see up here. We're in pretty good shape, sir.
Very well. Keep me informed. Out.
Eddington handed the radiophone back.
Colonel.
It was the major who ran his intelligence section.
We have some information for you.
Finally. The artillery fire continued, with a few rounds dropping right in the wadi. It was Colonel Berman's first experience with that, and he found that he didn't like it very much. It also explained why the tanks and tracks were spread out so much, which had struck him as very odd at first. One round went off 100 meters to the left of the tank behind which he and Major Abdullah were sheltering, thankfully to the far side. They both quite distinctly heard the pings of fragments hitting the brown-painted armor.
"This is not fun," Berman observed, shaking his head to clear the noise of the shell burst.
"Thank you for dealing with the rest of their guns. It was quite frightening," Abdullah said, looking through his binoculars.
The advancing UIR T-80s were just over 3,000 meters away, having not yet spotted his hull-down M1A2s.
"How long have you been in contact?"
"It started just after sunset yesterday. We are all that is left of the 4th Brigade."
And that didn't help Berman's confidence at all. Above their heads, the tank's turret made a slight adjustment to the left. There was a short phrase over the major's radio, and he replied with a single word, shouted, however. A second after that, the tank to the left of them jerked backward a foot or so, and a blast of fire erupted from the main gun. It made the artillery round seem like a firecracker in comparison. Against all logic, Berman raised his head. In the distance he saw a column of smoke, and tumbling atop it was a tank turret.
"Jesus! You have a radio I can use?"
"Sky One, this is Tiger Lead," an AWACS officer heard on a side channel. "I am on the ground with a Saudi tank group north of KKMC.
He gave the position next.
"We are in heavy contact here. Got any help you can send us? Over."
"Tiger, can you authenticate?"
"No, goddammit, my fucking codes went down with my 15. This is Colonel Steve Berman out of Mountain Home, and I am one very pissed-off aviator right now, Sky. 40 minutes ago we beat the snot out of some Iraqi artillery, and now we got tanks coming out the ass. You gonna believe me or not? Over."
"Sounds American to me," a more senior officer thought.
"And if you look close, their tanks are round on top and pointing south, and ours are flat on the top and pointing north. Over."
That bit of information was followed by the crash of an explosion.
"This ground-pounder shit ain't no fun at all," he told them.
"Me too," the first controller decided. "Tiger, stand by. Devil Lead, this is Sky One. We have some business for you." It wasn't supposed to be this way at all, but it was happening even so. There were supposed to be frag, for fragmentary, orders, detailing packages of tactical aircraft to hunting patches. But there weren't enough aircraft for that, and no time to select their patches either. Sky One had a flight of 4 F-16s waiting for some air-to-mud action, and this seemed as good a time as any. The advancing tanks stopped to trade fire at first,
but that was a losing game against the fire control systems on the American-made Abrams tanks, and these Saudi crews had gotten a postgraduate course in gunnery earlier in the day. The enemy backed off and maneuvered left and right, blowing smoke from their rear decks to obscure the battlefield. More vehicles were left behind, contributing their own black columns to the morning sky as their ammunition racks cooled off. The initial part of the engagement had lasted 5 minutes and had cost the UIR 20 vehicles that Berman could see, with no losses for the friendlies. Maybe this wasn't so bad after all. The Vipers came in from the west, hardly visible about 4 miles downrange, dropping their Mark 82 dumb bombs in the middle of the enemy formation. "Brilliant," the English-educated Major Abdullah said. They couldn't tell how many vehicles had died as a result, but now his men knew they were not alone in their engagement. That made a difference. If anything, the streets of Tehran had become grimmer still. What struck Clark and Chavez, Clerk and Chekhov currently, was the absence of conversation. People moved along without speaking to one another. There was also a sudden shortage of men, as reserves were being called up to trek into their armories, draw weapons, and prepare to move into the war which their new country had half-heartedly announced after President Ryan's preemption. The Russians had given them the location of Daryai's home, and their job really was only to look at it, which was easily said, but rather a different task on the streets of the capital city of the country with which you were at war. Especially if you had been in that city shortly before and seen by members of its security force. The complications were piling up. The man lived modestly, they saw, from 2.5 blocks away. It was a 3-story building on a middle-class street that displayed no trappings of power at all, except for the obvious presence of guards on the front steps, and a few cars spotted at the corners. Looking closer from 200 meters away, they could also see that people avoided walking on that side of the street. Popular man, the Ayatollah. "So who else lives there?" Clerk asked the Russian resident. He was covered as the embassy's second secretary, and performed many diplomatic functions to maintain his legend.
"Mainly his bodyguards, we believe."
They were sitting in a café, drinking coffee, and studiously not looking directly at the building of their interest.
"To either side, we think the buildings have been vacated. He has his security concerns, this man of God. The people here are increasingly uneasy under his rule. Even the enthusiasm of the Iraqi conquest fades now. You can see the mood as well as I, Clerk. These people have been under control for almost a generation. They grow tired of it. And it was clever of your president to announce hostilities before our friend did. The shock value was very effective, I think. I like your president," he added. "So does Sergei Nikolaevich."
"This building is close enough, Ivan Sergeyevich," Chavez said quietly, calling the cafe clutch back to order. 200 meters, direct line of sight."
"What about collateral damage?" Clark wondered.
It required some circumlocutions to make that come out in Russian.
"You Americans are so sentimental about such things," the resident observed. It amused him.
"Comrade Clerk has always had a soft heart," Chekhov confirmed. At Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico, a total of 8 pilots arrived at the base hospital to have their blood checked. The Ebola testing kits were finally coming out in numbers. The first major military deliveries went to the Air Force, which could deploy more power more quickly than the other branches of the service. There had been a few cases in nearby Albuquerque, all being treated at the University of New Mexico Medical Center, and 2 on this very base, a sergeant and his wife, the former dead and the latter dying. The news of it was all over the base, further enraging warriors who already possessed a surfeit of passion. The aviators all checked out clean, and the relief they felt was not ordinary. Now they knew they could go out and do something. The ground crews came in next. These also tested negative. All went off to the flight line. 1/2 of the pilots strapped into F-117 Nighthawks. The other half, with the ground crews, boarded KC-10 tanker transport aircraft for the long flight to Saudi.
Word was coming in over the Air Force's own communications network. The 366th and the F-16s from the Israeli base were doing pretty well, but everyone wanted a piece of this one, and the men and women from Holloman would lead the second wave into the battle zone.
"Is he quite mad?" the diplomat asked an Iranian colleague.
It was the RVS officers who had the dangerous, or at least most sensitive, part of the intelligence mission.
"You may not speak of our leader in that way," the foreign ministry official replied as they walked down the street.
"Very well. Does your learned holy man fully understand what happens when one employs weapons of mass destruction?" the intelligence officer asked delicately. Of course he did not, they both knew. No nation-state had done such a thing in over 50 years.
"He may have miscalculated," the Iranian allowed.
"Indeed."
The Russian let it go at that for the moment. He'd been working this mid-level diplomat for over a year.
"The world now knows that you have this capability. So clever of him to have flown on the very aircraft that made it possible. He is quite mad, you know that. Your country will be a pariah."
"Not if we can."
"No, not if you can."
"But what if you cannot?" the Russian asked.
"Then the entire world will turn against you."
"This is true?" the cleric asked.
"It is quite true," the man from Moscow assured him.
"President Ryan is a man of honor. He was our enemy for most of his life, and a dangerous enemy, but now, with peace between us, he turns into a friend. He is well respected by both the Israelis and the Saudis. The Prince Ali bin Sheikh and he are very close. That is well known." This meeting was in Ashgabat, capital of Turkmenistan, disagreeably close to the Iranian border, especially with the former premier dead in a traffic accident, probably a creative one, Moscow knew, and elections pending.
"Ask yourself this. Why did President Ryan say those things about Islam? An attack on his country? An attack on his child? An attack on himself? But does he attack your religion, my friend? No, he does not. Who but an honorable man would say such things?"
The man on the other side of the table nodded.
"This is possible. What do you ask of me?"
"A simple question. You are a man of God. Can you condone those acts committed by the UIR?"
Indignation. "The taking of innocent life is hateful to Allah. Everyone knows that."
The Russian nodded.
"Then you must decide for yourself which is more important to you, political power or your faith."
But it wasn't quite that simple.
"What do you offer us? I have people who will soon look to me for their welfare. You may not use the faith as a weapon against the faithful." "Increased autonomy? Free trade of your goods to the rest of the world? Direct flights to foreign lands? We and the Americans will help you to arrange lines of credit with the Islamic states of the Gulf. They do not forget acts of friendship," he assured the next premier of Turkmenistan.
"How can a man faithful to God do such things?"
"My friend,"
he wasn't really, but that was what one said,
"how many men start to do something noble and then become corrupted? And then what do they stand for? Perhaps it is a lesson for you to remember. Power is a deadly thing, most deadly of all to those who hold it in their earthly hands. For yourself you must decide. What sort of leader do you wish to be? And with what other leaders will you associate your country?"
Golovko leaned back and sipped at his tea. How wrong his country had been not to understand religion, and yet how right was the result. This man had clung to his Islamic faith as an anchor against the previous regime, finding in it a continuity of belief and values which the political reality of his youth had lacked. Now that his character, known to all in the land, was carrying him to political power, would he remain what he had been? Or would he become something else? He had to recognize that danger now. He hadn't thought it all the way through, Golovko saw. Political figures so rarely did. This one had to do so, and right now. and the chairman of the RVS watched him search his soul, something the Marxist doctrine of his youth had told him did not exist. It turned out to be better that it did.
Our religion, our faith, it is a thing of God, not of murder. The prophet teaches holy war, yes, but it does not teach us to become our enemies. Unless Mahmud Haji proves these things are false, I will not stand with him, for all his promises of money. I would like to meet this Ryan, when the time comes.
By 1300 Lima time, the picture was firming up nicely. The numbers were still pretty unattractive, Diggs thought, with 5 concentrated divisions on the move facing 4 brigade-sized forces, which were still dispersed. But there were things that could be done about that. The small Saudi blocking force north of KKMC had held for 3 spectacular hours, but was now being enveloped and had to move, despite the wishes of the Saudi general staff. Diggs didn't even know the kid's name, but hoped to meet him later. With a couple years of proper training, he might really turn into something. At his suggestion, King Khalid Military City was being evacuated. The one part about that which hurt was turning off the intelligence assets there, especially the Predator teams, which now had to recall their birds for their withdrawal to Wolfpack's line north of Al-Artawiya. Now that they'd all had time to think about it, the battle was like a huge training exercise at the NTC. 3 corps instead of battalions to face, but the principle was the same, wasn't it? The lingering concern was an Iranian heavy division, now known to be crossing the swamps west of Basra. The enemy's operational concept did leave one blank spot. In bypassing Kuwait, they had not had a covering force in place, perhaps because they thought it unnecessary. More likely because they didn't want to tip their hand, figuring to patch the hole as they were doing now. Well, every plan had a flaw. So did the plan he'd put together for Operation Buford, probably. But he didn't see it, despite 2 hours of looking. "Are we agreed, gentlemen?" he had to ask. Every Saudi officer in the room was still senior to him, but they'd come to see the logic of his proposal. They were going to fuck 'em all, not just a few. The assembled generals nodded. They didn't even complain anymore about leaving KKMC to the enemy. They could always rebuild it. Then Operation Buford commences at sundown. They fell back by echelon. A few Saudi mobile guns had appeared, and they now fired smoke to obscure the battlefield. As soon as they landed, half of Major Abdullah's vehicles backed off their positions and hurried south. The flanking units were already moving, fending off encirclement attempts which the enemy had adopted, probing expensively for the extreme ends of the Saudi line. Berman's helicopter had never arrived, and the afternoon of noisy and confusing action, you couldn't see crap down here, he had come to learn, had been instructive. Calling in 4 more airstrikes and seeing the effects on the ground was something he would keep in mind. If the Saudis clawed their way out of the trap, the other side was casting about them.
"Come with me, Colonel," Abdullah said, turning to run for his command track, ending the first battle of KKMC.
Chapter 61 Grierson's Ride. The view on the map was just awful. It was easy for anyone to see, a lot of long red arrows and short blue ones. The maps on the morning TV shows were not all that different from those in the Situation Room, and commentary, especially expert commentary, talked about how American and Saudi forces were badly outnumbered and poorly deployed, with their backs to the sea. But then there was the direct satellite feed. "We've heard stories of fierce air battles to the northwest," Donner told the camera from somewhere in Saudi Arabia. "But the troopers of the Black Horse Regiment have yet to see action. I can't say where I am right now. The fact of the matter is that I just don't know. B Troop is stopped for refueling now, pouring hundreds of gallons into those big M1 Abrams tanks. It's a real fuel hog, the troopers tell me.
but their mood remains the same. These are angry men, and women, back in the headquarters troop, he added. I don't know what we will find at the western horizon. I can say that these soldiers are straining at the leash despite all the bad news that has come down from the Saudi High Command. The enemy is somewhere out there, driving south in great strength, and soon after sundown we expect to make contact. This is Tom Donner in the field with the B Troop, 1st of the Black Horse, the report concluded.
His poise isn't bad, Ryan noted. When does that go on the air?
Fortunately for all concerned, the television uplinks were over military channels, which were encrypted and controlled. It wasn't time for the UIR to learn exactly who was where. The negative commentary of the defeat of the Saudi army was, however, going out. That news, leaked in Washington and studiously not commented on by the Pentagon, was being accepted as gospel. Jack was still worried, however amusing it might have been in the abstract, that the media was doing disinformation without even being asked.
This evening, maybe sooner, General Mickey Moore replied. Sunset over there is in 3 hours.
Can we do it? POTUS asked.
Yes, sir.
Wolfpack 1st Brigade North Carolina National Guard was fully formed now. Eddington took to a UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter for a flyover of his forward units. Lobo, his 1st Battalion Task Force, had its left edge on the road from Al-Artawiya to KKMC. White Fang, the 2nd, was arrayed to the west side of the highway. Coyote, the 3rd, was in reserve, his maneuver force leaning to the west, because that's where he thought the possibilities were. His artillery battalion he split into 2 segments, able to cover the left or right extremes, and both able to cover the center. He lacked air assets and had been unable to get anything more than 3 Blackhawks for medevac. He also had an intelligence group, a combat support battalion, medical personnel, MPs, and all the other things organic to a unit of brigade size. Forward of his 2 frontline battalions was a reconnaissance element whose mission was, 1st, to report, and 2nd, to take out the enemy's eyes when they appeared. He'd thought of asking the 11th ACR for some of their helicopter assets, but he knew what Ham had planned for those, and it was a waste of breath to ask. He would get the take from their reconnaissance efforts, and that would have to do. Looking down, he saw that the forward line of M1A2s and Bradleys had all found comfortable spots, mainly behind berms and mini-dunes, where possible just behind high ground, so that, at most, the top of a turret was visible, and mainly not even that. Just the track commander's head and a pair of binoculars would suffice in most cases. The tanks were spaced no less than 300 meters apart, and mostly more than that. It made them an unattractively diluted target for artillery or air attack. He'd been told not to worry about the latter, but he worried anyway, as much as circumstances allowed. His subordinate commanders knew their jobs as well as reservists could, and the truth of the matter was that the mission was right out of the textbooks written by Guderian and practiced by Rommel and every mounted commander ever since. The withdrawal started with a 10-mile dash at 35 miles per hour, enough to outrun artillery fire, and to look like the route that Berman initially thought it to be, until he remembered that he made a practice of leaving enemy fire behind at least 15 times as fast as these mechanized vehicles were doing. They were riding with top hatches open, and Berman stood to look behind, past the brown-black fountains of exploding artillery shells. He'd never known what a defensive stand was like. Mainly lonely, he thought. He'd expected bunched vehicles and men, forgetting what he himself did to such things when he spotted them from the air. He saw what had to be 50 columns of smoke, all vehicles blown apart by the Saudi National Guard. Maybe they didn't take training seriously enough. He had heard such things. But this team had stood their ground against a force at least 5 times as large, and held them for 3 hours. Not without cost. He turned forward and counted only 15 tanks, plus 8 infantry tracks.
Perhaps there were more he couldn't see in the clouds of dust, he hoped. He looked up into what he hoped was a friendly sky. It was. The score since dawn was 40 UIR fighters down, all of them air-to-air, against 6 American and Saudi losses, all of them ground-to-air. The opposing Air Force had been unable to overcome the advantage of the Allied airborne radar coverage, and the best thing that could be said for their effort was that they had distracted efforts to attack the ground forces, which would otherwise have been totally unimpeded. The ragtag collection of American, French, and Russian-made fighter aircraft looked impressive on paper and on the ramp, but less so in the air. But the Allied air forces were far less capable at night. Only the small collection of F-15E Strike Eagles was really all-weather capable. Night is considered a weather condition. There were about 20 of those, UIR intelligence estimated, and couldn't do all that much harm. The advancing divisions halted right before KKMC, again to refuel and rearm. One more such jump, their commanders thought, and they'd be to Riyadh before the Americans were organized enough to take the field. They still had the initiative and were halfway to their objective. Pombal kept track of all that, feeding what radio intercepts it was garnering from the southwest, but now facing a new threat to the north from an Iranian armored division. Perhaps the UIR had expected that, with the kingdom out of the way, or at least heavily engaged, the Kuwaitis would be intimidated into inaction. If so, it was wishful thinking. Borders could be crossed in two directions, and Kuwait's government made the correct assumption that doing nothing would only make things worse for them, not better. It turned out to be another case of one more day needed to patch things up, but this time it was the other side which needed the extra time. The Air Cavalry Squadron, 4th of the 10th, lifted off 20 minutes after sunset, heading north. There were some light motorized units on border guard duty, soon they thought to be relieved by the unit now crossing the Tigris-Euphrates Delta. It comprised 2 battalions of troops in trucks and light armored vehicles. They'd chatted quite a bit on their radios, the commanders moving units back and forth, but strangely unprepared to be invaded by a nation not a tenth the size of their own. For the next hour, all 26 of the Buffalo Cavs Apaches would hunt them with cannon and rocket fire, burning a path for Kuwait's own light mechanized brigade, whose reconnaissance vehicles fanned out, searching for and finding the lead elements of Iranian armor. 5 kilometers back was a battalion of heavy armor guided by the reconnaissance information, and the first major surprise of the night for the UIR was the sundering of nightfall by 20 tank guns, followed 2 seconds later by 15 kills. The next lesson applied was that of confidence. Their first contact with the enemy a successful one, the lead Kuwaiti elements pressed the attack with gusto. It was all coming together for them. The night vision systems worked. The guns worked. They had an enemy with his back to unsuitable ground and no place to go. Listening at Pombal, Major Sabah heard the radio calls, again experiencing things at second hand. It turned out that only 1 brigade of the Iranian 4th Armored Division, mainly a reserve formation, had gotten across, and had driven blithely and unwarned into an advancing armor force. It was, Sabah thought, just about as fair as what had happened to his country on the morning of 1 August 1990. By sunset, plus 3 hours, the only usable access route into southern Iraq was completely blocked, and with it easy reinforcement of the Army of God. Throughout the night, precision-guided bombs would drop bridges to make certain of that. It was a small battle for his small nation, but a winning one to set the stage for her nation's allies. The Buffalo Cav was already moving its ground elements due west, while the Air Cav Squadron returned to refuel and rearm, leaving a buoyant Kuwaiti army holding the Allied rear and spoiling for another battle. The UIR First Corps had been in reverse until this point. 1 division was the former Iranian First Armored, the Immortals,
accompanied by another armored division comprised mainly of surviving Republican Guards officers, and a new class of enlisted men untouched by the 1991 war. Second Corps had made the breakthrough at the border and held the lead for the advance to KKMC, though in the course of combat action losing more than a third of its strength. That task accomplished, it moved left, east, clearing the path for First Corps, as yet untouched except by a few air attacks, and Third Corps similarly untouched. Second Corps would now guard the flank of the advancing force against counterstrikes fully expected from the seaward side. All units, following their doctrine, sent out reconnaissance forces as darkness fell. The lead units, advancing by bounds, skirted around King Khalid Military City, surprised to find no opposition. Emboldened, the commander of the reconnaissance battalion sent units directly into the city, then found it virtually empty of people, most of whom had driven out during the previous day. It seemed logical when he thought about it. The army of God was advancing, and though it had taken a few heavy blows, nothing the Saudis had could stop it. Satisfied, he pressed south, a little more cautiously now. There had to be some opposition ahead. Eddington's MP detachment had done its job conveying people south and out of the way. He'd seen a few faces, downcast mainly, until they'd gotten a look at what was waiting between KKMC and Al-Artawiya. Wolfpack couldn't hide everything. Saudi MP units brought up the rear, passing through the recon screen at 2100 local time. They'd said that there was nothing behind them. They were wrong. With his soft vehicles in the lead and his fighting tracks guarding the rear with their turrets turned aft, Major Abdullah had thought about making one more stand, but didn't have the combat power to hold much of anything against what he knew had to be behind him. His men were exhausted by 24 hours of continuous combat operations, and the worst off were his tank drivers. Their position in the front of their vehicles was so comfortable as to cause them to fall asleep, only to be awakened by the shouts of their tank commanders, or the lurch of heading off the road into a ditch. His additional concern was that he'd expected to make contact with friendly units. Battlefields, he'd learned in the past day, were anything but friendly places. They appeared as white blobs at first on the thermal imaging scopes, the vehicles straggling down the highway. Eddington, in his command post, knew that there might be some Saudi stragglers downbound, and had warned his recon screen to expect it. But it wasn't until the evening's predators took to the sky that he was sure. Through the thermal viewers, the distinctive flat top of the M1A2 tanks was clearly visible. This information he relayed to Hoot Owl, his recon detachment, which lessened their tension as the shapeless thermal blobs on their ground-based viewing systems gradually turned into friendlier profiles. Even then, there was the chance that friendly vehicles had been captured and converted to enemy use. Troopers cracked chemical light wands and dropped them on the road. These were spotted, and the advancing trucks stopped practically on top of them, even rolling slowly as they were, without lights. A handful of Saudi liaison officers assigned to Wolfpack verified their identity and waved them south. Major Abdullah, arriving at the screening position 10 minutes later, jumped out of his command track, along with Colonel Berman. The American guardsman handed over food and water first of all, quickly followed by GI coffee out of their MRE packs, the sort with triple the normal amount of caffeine.
"They're a ways back, but they're coming," Berman said. "My friend here, well, he's had a busy day."
The Saudi major was at the point of collapse, the physical and mental exertions like nothing he'd ever known. He staggered over to the Hoot Owl command post, and over a map relayed what he knew as coherently as he could.
"We must stop them," he concluded.
"Major, why don't you head on down about 10 miles, and you'll see the biggest fucking roadblock ever was.
Nice job, son," the lawyer from Charlotte told the young man. The major walked off toward his track.
"Was it that tough?" he asked Berman when the Saudi was out of earshot.
"I know they killed 50 tanks, and that's just the ones I could see," Berman said, sipping coffee from a metal cup.
A lot more coming, though.
Really? The lawyer, Lieutenant Colonel, said. That suits us just fine. No friendlies back of you?
Berman shook his head. No chance.
You head on down the road now, Berman, 10 miles, and then you watch the show, you hear?
They looked like Americans, Berman saw, in their desert BDUs, their faces painted under the German-shaped Fritz helmets. There were red-shielded lights to point at the maps. It was dark out here, about as dark as a clear sky could get, just the stars enabling him to tell the difference between land and sky. A sliver of moon would appear later, but that wouldn't be much. The screen commander had a command Humvee with lots of radios. Beyond, he could see a single Bradley, a few troops, and little else. But they stood like Americans, and they spoke like Americans.
Hoot 6, this is 2-9er. 2-9er, 6, go, the commander took the radio. We have some movement, 5 miles north of our position, 2 vehicles nosing around right on the horizon. Roger, 2-9er, keep us informed, out. He turned to Berman. Get going, Colonel, we have work to do here.
There was a flanking screen. That would be the enemy Second Corps, Colonel Ham thought. His forward line of Kiowa scout helicopters was now watching it. The Kiowas, the military version of the Bell 206, the copter most often used in America for reporting on traffic congestion, specialized in hiding, most often behind hills and ridges, with just the top-mounted electronic periscope peering about the terrain while the pilot held his aircraft in hover, seeing but not seen, while the TV systems recorded the event, relaying their take back. Ham had 6 of them up now, advanced scouts for his 4th Squadron, 10 miles in front of his ground elements, now lying still 30 miles southeast of KKMC. While he watched his display in the Star Wars track, technicians converted the information from the Kiowa scouts into data that could be displayed graphically and distributed to the fighting vehicles in his command. Next came data from the Predator drones. They were up, covering the roads and desert south of the captured city, with one drone over it. The streets, he saw, were full of fuel and supply trucks. It was a convenient place to hide them. Most important, electronic sensors were now at work. The UIR forces were moving too fast to rely on radio silence. Commanders had to talk back and forth. Those sources were moving, but they were moving predictably now, talking almost all the time, as commanders told subunits where to go and what to do, got information and reported it up the chain. He had 2 brigade CPs positively identified, and probably a divisional one, too. Ham changed display to get the larger picture. 2 divisions were moving south from KKMC now. That would be the enemy First Corps, spread on a 10-mile frontage, 2 divisions moving abreast in columns of brigades, a tank brigade in front, mobile artillery right behind it. Second Corps was moving to their left, spread thin to provide flank guard. Third Corps appeared to be in reserve. The deployment was conventional and predictable. First contact with Wolfpack would be in about an hour, and he would hold back until then, allowing First Corps to pass north to south, right to left along his front. There hadn't been time to prepare the battlefield properly. The guard troops lacked a full engineer detachment, and the anti-tank mines they might have strewn to dirty up the terrain. There hadn't been time to prepare proper obstacles and traps. They'd scarcely been in place for 10 hours, and the full brigade less than that. All they really had was a fire plan. Wolfpack could shoot short wherever it wanted, but all deep fire had to be west of the road.
"Pretty good picture here, sir," his S-2 intelligence officer said. "Send it out."
And with that, every fighting vehicle in the Black Horse had the same digital picture of the enemy that he had. Then Ham lifted his radio.
"Wolfpack 6, this is Black Horse 6. "This is Wolfpack 6 actual. Thanks for the data feed, Colonel," Eddington replied over the digital radio. Both units also knew where all the friendlies were. "I'd say initial contact in about an hour."
"Ready to rock, Nick?" Ham asked.
"Al, it's all I can do to hold my boys back. We are locked and cocked," the guard commander assured him. "We have visual on their advance screen now."
"You know the drill, Nick. Good luck."
"Black Horse?"
Eddington said in parting. Ham changed settings on his radio, calling Buford 6.
"I have the picture, Al," Marion Diggs assured him, 100 miles back and not liking that fact one bit. He was sending men into battle by remote control, and that came hard to a new general officer.
"Okay, sir, we are fully in place. All they have to do is walk in the door."
"Roger, Blackhorse, standing by here. Out."
The most important work was now being done by the Predators. The UAV operators, sighted with Ham's intelligence section, circled their mini-aircraft higher to minimize the chance they might be spotted or heard. Cameras pointed down, counting and checking locations. The Immortals were on the enemy left, and the former Iraqi Guards Division on the right, west of the road. They were moving along steadily, battalions on line and tightly packed for maximum power and shock effect if they encountered opposition, 10 miles behind their own reconnaissance screen. Behind the lead brigade was the divisional artillery. This force was divided in two, and as they watched in the intel track, one half halted, spread out, and set up to provide covering fire, while the other half took up and moved forward. Again, that was right out of the book. They would be in place for about 90 minutes. The Predators flew over the line of guns, marking their position from GPS signals. That data went down to the MLRS batteries. Two more Predators were sent along. These were dedicated to getting exact locations on enemy command vehicles.
"Well, I'm not sure when this will go out," Donner told the camera. "I'm here inside Bravo 3-2, number 2 scout track in 3rd platoon of B Troop. We just got information on where the enemy is. He's about 20 miles west of us right now. There are at least 2 divisions moving south on the road from King Khalid Military City. I know now that a brigade of the North Carolina National Guard is in a blocking position. They deployed with the 11th Cavalry Regiment because they were at the National Training Center for routine training.
The mood here, well, how can I explain this? The troopers of the Black Horse Regiment, they're almost like doctors, strange as that may sound. These men are angry at what's happened to their country, and I've talked to them about it. But right now, like doctors waiting for the ambulance to come into the emergency room. It's quiet in the track. We just heard that we'll be moving west in a few minutes to the jump-off point. I want to add a personal note. Not long ago, as you all know, I violated a rule of my profession. I did something wrong. I was misled, but the fault was mine. I learned earlier today that the President himself requested that I should come here. Maybe to get me killed? Donner ad-libbed in an obvious joke. No, not that. This is the sort of situation that people in the news business live for. I am here where history may soon take place, surrounded by other Americans who have an important job to do. And however this turns out, this is where a reporter belongs. President Ryan, thank you for the chance. This is Tom Donner, southeast of KKMC, with B Troop, 1st Squadron of the Black Horse. He lowered the mic. Got that? Yes, sir, the Army Spec 5 told him. The soldier said something into his own microphone. Okay, that went up to the satellite, sir. Good one, Tom, the track commander said, lighting up a cigarette. Come here, I'll show you how this IVUS thing works, and... He stopped, holding his helmet with his hand to hear what was coming over the radio. Start her up, Stanley, he told the driver. It's showtime.
He let them come in. The man commanding the Wolfpack's reconnaissance screen was a criminal defense attorney by profession who'd actually graduated from West Point, but later decided on a civilian career. He'd never quite lost the bug, as he thought of it, though he didn't quite know why. Age 45 now, he'd been in uniformed service of one sort or another for almost 30 years of drills and exhausting exercise and mind-numbing routine, which took away from his time and his family. Now in the front line of his recon force, he knew why. The lead scout vehicles were 2 miles to his front. He estimated 2 platoons that he could see, a total of 10 vehicles spread across 3 miles, moving 3 or 4 at a time in the darkness. Maybe they had low-light gear.
He wasn't sure of that, but had to assume that they did.
On his thermal systems, he could make them out as Burdum II scout cars, four-wheeled, equipped with a heavy machine gun or anti-tank missiles. He saw both versions, but he was especially looking for the one with four radio antennas. That would be the platoon or company commander's vehicle.